Welcome to the One Within All to the Universe podcast. I'm your host, Chance Garten, ready to once again dig into the headiest questions and most imaginably expansive ideas for you to consider in this beautiful now. You've probably heard those cliche notions that there's a universe inside you and that you're not a drop in the ocean, but the ocean in a drop. And yes, my own personal experiences in that regard are what led me to years ago create this ongoing conversation about consciousness called the Innerverse that you know and love. I'm sure most of you out there are right there with me, having had your own encounters with the source and singularity of all life through spiritual practices, psychedelic insights, or near-death encounters that have led you to hold a similar awareness about the intrinsically infinite nature of your capital S self. But what do we do about moving the dial of the larger cultural conditioning around the big cosmological questions? How do you convince the entrenched materialist to start peeking around the corners of that all-too-constricting box of physicalism? Our guest for today began his multi-book authorship quest, seeking to solve that very conundrum, and it's to our great benefit that we are about to receive some of his nuggets of existential gnosis. His name is Mark Gober, and after graduating magna cum laude from Princeton University, where he was the captain of his tennis team, he began making his way in the world as a New York investment banker, riding out the financial crisis of 2008, before eventually shifting to a position as a partner at a Silicon Valley strategy firm. Somewhere along the way, he began to wonder about life's big mysteries, leading him to embark on a journey of discovery that's led to the 6 books of his Upside Down series, to host a podcast in 2019 known as Where Is My Mind, and serve on the board of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For today's chat, I've fully vetted both his first and last books and into Upside Down Thinking, which confronts scientism's inability to address the hard problem of consciousness, and an end to Upside Down Medicine, which bravely pokes the medical industrial complex's most glaring misconceptions right in both eyes. Both of these books are awash with hard data and profound conclusions, and on their own would be more than enough to turn anyone's thinking from inverted and insane towards converted to a more humane and harmonious way of interfacing with this amazing world and the beauty of life. He's doing the most important sort of work for our modern age and blending the qualities of an enlightened sage to take our thinking out of its self-limiting cage, and I couldn't be more honored to have a chance to speak with him. Special shout out to Eileen Day McCusick for setting up this chat. And with that, let's get into it with the universal mind finder and health paradigm redesigner, the great Mark Gober. Welcome to the show, man, and thanks for being here.
Wow, thank you, Chance, and I really appreciate that amazing introduction.
I was inspired, obviously. Your books got me going, man. But if you want to add anything about how you would introduce yourself, I'd love to give you the shot.
You covered the highlights. I would just emphasize how different I used to be in terms of my thinking before I started writing. I was a hardcore materialist, and increasingly so as I got older, where I thought, well, just science shows us that those old superstitious, spiritual, religious beliefs, there's nothing to them, and we live in a random and meaningless universe. I was firmly in that camp and had this shift starting in 2016. I was listening to podcasts and started to read books and scientific papers, and that was like the first domino that's led me on this path to explore not only medicine and consciousness, but even political issues and socioeconomic issues, the UFO phenomenon, all of it pertaining to the nature of reality and who and why we're here.
Yeah, which is, I think, the most fun stuff to investigate. Definitely see why you'd get hooked on writing if these are the type of things you're investigating. And to kind of just flow right into an end to upside down thinking, which I found to be one of the best compilations of the actual research on the topics of expanded consciousness experiences and psi phenomenon. And the proof that the results of these psychic experiments are not the result of chance. That's right. I didn't do it. But, you know, a quote from that book that I really enjoyed was, "I, that is experiencing this life of Mark, has exactly the same characteristics that any other would give to his or her I. Isolating I leads to the same conclusion about its characteristics. It is unlimited, self-aware, infinite, and eternal. All of us, as I, have those exact qualities." And so why I bring up this quote is that, you know, maybe the first thing that we could talk about is just ways that someone might be able to demonstrate to themselves that their body exists in their mind rather than the mind creating a body.
This is a tricky one because our sensory perceptual organs make it easy for us to infer a reality that's outside. But if we actually do the investigation into every kind of perception we have, we can find out that it always emerges within the mind. And then we reverse engineer and describe it as a, I touched that. Whereas we could say, well, that touching the chair is really just a sensation that we are processing within our own consciousness. And we could do that with vision, any kind of perception. It's always something within our consciousness. And then the question becomes, well, what is the consciousness that's having all of those experiences? It's the same experiencer within us that's having those perceptions. It's just the nature of those perceptions shift. And people on the path to enlightenment or whatever you want to call it, spiritual awakening, they talk about a process of subtraction. And it's like subtracting and getting rid of or letting go of the assumptions that we have or whatever we superimpose on situations. We come up with a whole complicated explanation of something when in reality, with regard to perceptions and sensations, it's always just in our consciousness. It's that simple.
Yeah, that, you know, I've learned the body is in your mind rather than the other way around directly from being a biofield tuning practitioner. My audience will have heard me talk about that a lot. But another thing that really helps move the dial on comprehending this would be the variety of psychic and consciousness powers that have been documented or studied. Would you mind giving us an overview of some of those?
This was really the entry point for me when I had my paradigm shift starting in 2016, when I learned that there was scientific evidence that apparently all humans and even other organisms like animals, I talk about that in the book and end upside down thinking too, that we have abilities that are basically like sci-fi abilities and they're innate within us. I was so confused learning about this. I'm like, wait, so I have these abilities and so does everyone else. How did I not know that about myself? And furthermore, along the same lines, there's a lot of evidence suggesting that when the physical body dies, that's not the end of our consciousness. In other words, that our sense of or capacity to experience continues when the body dies. And this first book, An End to Upside Down Thinking, was compiling the evidence in these areas. And my approach was that if even one of these so-called paranormal phenomena is real, and I don't like the word paranormal because it assumes what they know what normal is, but you know what I mean, hopefully, by paranormal. If even one of those is real, then it requires a shift in the mainstream scientific paradigm. So that book, An End to Upside Down Thinking, is just a lot of evidence geared toward someone like me. I mean, I was still working in Silicon Valley at the time, and I was thinking, I'm going to write this book, and I'm in the business world. Like, how could I do this in a credible way? Well, it's all like hundreds of citations. So that's the preface. So I'll give a few examples. Someone said to me, hey, Mark, like, what are the most compelling things to you? First one probably would be declassified documents from the CIA on the remote viewing program, which is the ability to perceive things with the mind that are far away in space and time. In other words, this is like psychic spying. And the US government started a program in the 1970s using psychic spying for national security. And in my podcast series, Where Is My Mind? I interviewed Russell Targ, who was one of the leaders of the program, in addition to Uri Geller, who was involved in remote viewing there, and other people who've been involved in it. So it's interesting. Anytime I talk to someone in the space, it's like, obviously this is real, like, because they've seen people do it. But in any event, the declassified documents, they say remote viewing is a real phenomenon. Implications are revolutionary. Evidence too impressive to dismiss as mere coincidence. That's what it says in the documents. And interestingly, we're talking now, just a few days ago, this is April 2024, a new document was declassified. And it talks about the UAP phenomenon a little bit, but it also talks about remote viewing and validates the reality of it. So as just a naive researcher or someone who said, I'm concerned about talking about this publicly, to be able to hold up a document. And in the book, I've got photocopies of these publicly available documents. They say remote viewing is a real phenomenon. I mean, that's kind of a hard thing to dispute. That's number one. Number two, I'll give two and then I'll give a third too. Number two, Dr. Jessica Utz, who's the 2016 president of the American Statistical Association. So this is someone who knows statistics. She knows how studies are done. She looked at the evidence for psychic phenomena, whether it's remote viewing or telepathy, which is mind-to-mind communication, psychokinesis, which is mind-matter interaction, meaning the mind impacting the material world without any physical contact, precognition. This is knowing or sensing the future before it happens. So she was looking at various studies in this. She said, using the standards applied to any other area of science, it is concluded that psychic functioning has been well established. And this was in a report she wrote in response to an inquiry about the government's remote viewing program in 1995. That's a very powerful statement. I remember one of my buddies who read my book when it first came out, he was just like, that to him, like, whoa. And same thing for me, because it just adds so much credibility to all the skeptics who say, yeah, it's bad science. I mean, this woman is putting her neck on the line, Dr. Jessica Utz. I give her a lot of credit and making that statement. Third one, I'll go to near-death experiences. So these are instances where a person is clinically dead in some cases, let's say cardiac arrest, blood stops flowing to the brain. And often they have elaborate experiences. Many of us have heard of them or heard people talk about them. But they're, in some of the cases, people have an out-of-body experience where they're actually, in terms of their consciousness, they have the sense of I-ness often, like being an individual, but they're hovering outside the body. And they can perceive things from that vantage point. And sometimes they have 360-degree vision. It's a realer than real experience. But the kicker here is that in some of these, when the person's resuscitated, they're able to convey what they perceived. So maybe they saw the resuscitation from above the body and they tell the doctor, I saw you do this, this, and this, or they overheard a conversation in another room, or they saw something they shouldn't have been able to see. And they tell the people who were not sick at the time, the doctor, family members, bystanders, what they perceived. And those bystanders verify the memory. So they validate what the person perceived. Therefore, we have a functional and non-hallucinatory consciousness at a time when the brain should not be able to produce anything like that. And there's no physiological explanation for people perceiving from that vantage point. They're called veridical out-of-body experiences. Veridical just means it's a verified memory. And it wipes out this idea that it's all just a hallucination. These are more difficult to document because not everyone knows they're going to have a near-death experience, let alone be able to document like what they saw and then report it. But there's a book called The Self Does Not Die, which has about 100 of these cases documented. And there are others in the literature too, which to me is very powerful. There should be zero of these documented cases. They can timestamp because they know when the memory occurred. They can see what the body was doing at that time. And even if you argue, well, maybe there was some residual brain functioning that didn't pick up, or maybe there was a spike in brain activity, that doesn't make any sense why they could perceive something from a vantage point outside the body, even if there's a little bit of brain activity. You would expect a lot of brain activity to have such a lucid, realer than real experience that's validated as accurate. So that's a very powerful one.
Yeah, all those examples are phenomenal. And you give a quote from the great Dean Radin in his book, Real Magic. Okay, here it is. Experiments on these phenomena have exceeded the Six Sigma threshold. This refers to studies where the overall odds against chance, after careful consideration of all known experiments investigating the same topic, are assessed to be over 1 billion to 1. Each of the experiments used protocols that avoid all known design flaws. An extensive due diligence list of possible design faults had been developed after years of intense scrutiny and criticism of these studies, leading to bulletproof designs. Each class of experiments has been repeated from a dozen to more than 100 times by independent investigators at different labs around the world, with each class cumulatively involving hundreds to thousands of participants, most of whom were not claiming any special psychic abilities. And, you know, so that's beyond the NDEs, which is a whole topic that I think we'll return to for sure. But in terms of the range and the airtightness of these various psychic phenomenon experiences and what the statistical data shows, can you elaborate on all that?
Yeah, it's a very powerful quote. I've used it in multiple of my books because if you hear from skeptics, they'll say, well, like the methodologies weren't good. There aren't any peer-reviewed papers. And by the way, there's also a 2018 paper in American Psychologist. This is the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Psychological Association. So basically as mainstream as you could get in psychology. And Dr. Etzel Cardenya from Lund University aggregated the statistics for many of these psychic phenomena, and the paper was actually published. So there's a momentum now where these things were just shunned before, but there are more publications in mainstream or mainstream-ish journals. And Dean Radin, who I've gotten to know because I'm on the board of IONS, and he's the chief scientist there and has been for a long time, he's been through all of this. He was also involved in like all sorts of other programs. He was at Princeton in the US government work. So he's seen the psychic phenomena world from every angle and seen the way the skeptics have been approaching this and the critiques. So it's helped the researchers actually refine their methodologies to make sure they're responding to their critiques. And what's happening over and over again, and this is why Dr. Jessica Utz, in statistics, she is validating what's going on, is because the methodologies they're using are airtight. Like Dean said, they have to be so careful because they know the skeptics are going to come out and they know what they have to do to even try to appeal to certain peer-reviewed journals. In some cases, the journals will say they'll just reject the paper because they won't touch the subject matter. So there is that resistance still. But what Dean does in that book, Real Magic, I believe it's chapter 6. It's just such a powerful way to start it. The chapter's called Scientific Evidence. And it's like, he just goes through all these categories and says, this is Six Sigma results, more than 1 billion to 1 odds against chance in all these different categories. Like I'll repeat them: telepathy, mind-to-mind communication, psychokinesis, mind-matter interaction, remote viewing, seeing or sensing something far away in both space and time, precognition, knowing or sensing the future. I mean, these are sci-fi concepts that are shown to be real in controlled studies. What does that mean about what we are as humans? And what does it mean that we're not told we have these abilities?
Yeah, these are really big questions. I'm wondering, you know, to go back to the time when you were the financial analyst, did you ever see the Pixar movie Soul?
A bunch of people recommended it to me. So I'm familiar with the concept.
You know, I'm not the biggest Disney fan or whatever, but there's this concept in the movie where, like, in the spiritual realm, there's this area called the zone, and people that are in the flow state, their soul is like elevated into the zone, and they're sort of just fluidly, automatically doing whatever their craft or their activity is. But then at the bottom of the zone, like on the floor, there are the people who are obsessive compulsively in their flow state, doing something that is maybe not their soul's highest calling. Mm-hmm. And so the characters are in the zone area, and they accidentally like wake up or startle one of the almost like demonically possessed lower souls that's trudging through the zone. And the soul wakes up, and in the real world, there's this guy at a desk with all the computers analyzing all of the stock tickers and stuff. And he just like snaps out of it. And he's like, what am I doing with my life? And he just gets up and flees the room or something. Was that kind of how it felt for you whenever you were leaving that world?
It did. The caveat I would give is that I always felt like something was wrong with that world. From day one in investment banking, I knew. I was like, I can't believe this. But I did it just because I wanted to push through, and I could rationalize why it would be a good thing for me to do in my career, like that kind of mentality. But I was never in it, even though I was blindfolded in a sense. So there was maybe this spark within me that always was looking for something new. And then what happened was basically it just got more and more brutal in different ways, personal life, professional life, where I was forced to wake up. And some call that the dark night of the soul. I write about this more in my second book, An End to Upside Down Living, which is about the spiritual awakening process, both my own, but mostly other people throughout history and also contemporary, like the process you go through. And there's so many similarities that it might be different situations, whether it's like me working in finance and strategy consulting in Silicon Valley versus someone else doing another job, the process can be very similar, where the universe or whatever it is seems to jolt you when you're not on the right path, and then you're forced to wake up or continue to experience more pain. And I was on this treadmill hitting a wall over and over again. And through apparently luck or something, I was listening to podcasts that just got me started on this journey. But I was firmly in that asleep phase and then jolted out of it. And I mean, I feel like I've adjusted more to being out of it. But then once you're out of it, there's continued awakenings. And we were talking before the show, I generally agree with my first book. But as I write books, if I go back and read certain sentences, I would probably change things or say, I assume this to be true just because it was consensus in science and I didn't know you should question it. But now I would question it. So it's like a continual awakening process.
That's what made it so fun for me to listen to. I didn't read, but I listened to the first and the last, which are narrated by you, by the way. So people who prefer to have the actual author reading the book to them, they'll enjoy the flavor of the books for that reason. But as your awakening process seemed to coincide with you writing, what do you think about creativity as the way to push through these dark nights? Or how did that creative process seem to be related to your spiritual development?
When I started researching, I didn't know I was going to write books or speak publicly. That wasn't the plan. I was just interested and I wanted to know more. And it was for the first time in my life, maybe, where I felt this passion. I've got to do this. When I wasn't working in the office or working on a client thing, I'm like, I've got to research more about these NDEs or psychic phenomena. Is this real? If it's real, I got to understand why. And I need to be able to communicate it to people so they don't think I'm totally nuts. Like, how am I going to exist in the world with this sort of belief system when everyone else around me is more like I used to be, which is basically a zombie-esque state, not being aware of these other things? So that was going through my mind. And it was about a year into this research. So I had my awakening in the summer of 2016. In the summer of 2017, I got this inclination that maybe I should put my research down on paper so that other people can have an efficient way to learn about this stuff without having to look at like hundreds of sources in the way that I did. I put it all in one place and cite everything, then maybe they'll have an awakening too, and it'll be positive for them. So I just felt like I needed to do it. And then I became an investment banker again and said, I'm going to write this as fast as I can. And it happened very quickly. But what I found is that similar process every time is that I get wind of a paradigm shift that I realize, wow, I need to learn about this. Could this be right? Let me see. I can't poke holes in it. And I'm sure we'll talk about medicine later because we get into pathogenicity of microbes and things like that. And that was a paradigm shift for me where I was questioning, but every other one along the way, I'm like, could this be real? And the deeper I go, always, I realize that there's validity to it and I can't poke holes into it. There's always an answer for every doubt. And then I say, I need to learn about this. I need to become fluent in it. Oh, I should summarize this in a book. So far, that's happened 6 times. I don't know if it's going to happen again, but it is a similar process every time.
And now my next question is, you know, in the process, and I guess this could apply to any of your books that involve the quote, unquote, paranormal. But have you experienced any of these like expanded consciousness states or psi phenomenon personally, or UFOs or things of that nature?
I would say compared to what I've researched, my personal experiences have been mild, other than the arc of my journey, which is mystical in a different way of seeing where I used to be versus where I am now. That's a pretty mystical thing. But I haven't had an abduction experience or encountered a being. When I first started off, though, and I learned about the evidence for psychic phenomena and other things, I did engage with lots of psychics and energy healers and past life regression, hypnosis people. So I was exploring all that stuff, human design. I wanted to know if there was validity to it. And there were a lot of people who were able to know things or tell me things that they shouldn't have been able to. There was no way. And it happened enough times. I mean, not every time. There were certainly things where they were wrong, but enough times where they were right about something specific that it freaked me out. And it was like, okay, this is validating what I'm researching, at least sometimes. And it actually aligns with the statistics. Typically, people are not 100% accurate in terms of their psychic abilities. They're just more accurate than chance would predict. So if chance would say you're supposed to get it right 25% of the time, if you're supposed to guess correctly 1 out of 4 times, people guess correctly like 32% of the time in these telepathy studies. Well, that's statistically a massive thing, but it's not 100%. That means we get things wrong. So that was actually the fact that they weren't getting it right 100% of the time was validating the statistics.
especially on like over and over hundreds of repeats of the study, then that 5-7% variance from the expected probability becomes exponentially less probable when it's repeated over and over and over again to have that variance.
Exactly. That's a good point. And then it's like, well, why is that happening? Some information seems to be getting through. And these are ordinary people who aren't even training. So like in the US government's program, those are trained people who might even have a greater innate ability. And I like to think of these psychic abilities sort of as sports, where you could have someone who's Michael Jordan or LeBron James, or you could have an everyday person who dribbles a basketball. They're on the same spectrum, but some are naturally more talented and they put in the work. That would probably be like the people at the US government's program, who I'm sure do better than the 32%. But the point is that even for an everyday person, they're getting at that 32% range, which, like you said, is very significant. The other category of experiences I've had is with meditation. So there were two different times. This was after the first book came out. And one of them came, so right before everything with COVID happened, this was in 2019, early 2020, I decided to leave my firm in Silicon Valley. And I said, I'm not sure what I want to do next, but I don't want to continue doing this. I just didn't feel energetically aligned. So when that happened, I went on three retreats in 5 weeks, which I never had the time to do before. I did a Panchakarma Ayurvedic retreat in New Mexico, and it was 5 days long. Then I took a week off. Then I did a nearly week-long silent meditation retreat with a woman named Mukti, who's Adyashanti's wife. Adyashanti is a well-known teacher. Then I took a week off. And in that week, I wrote the first draft of my book, An End Upside Down Living. And then I went on a third silent retreat with Adyashanti, which was, I don't know, 6 days or something. After I came back from, I don't know if it was Adyashanti's or might've been the other one before that, Mukti's, I can't remember. I was meditating and had this experience of some kind of very lightness that filled the density of my body. And I felt like I was going to disappear. It was like a bliss out beyond what I could really describe. It was very short lived. And my body in a split second said, you got to shut this down or you're not going to exist anymore. And that would upset people around you. You can't do that. And like,
been there.
Yeah, it was wild. And I had another one of those following a different a Kriya yoga retreat I had done like 6 months ago. That was just a short one. And it was a similar kind of sensation that overcame me. So those were both very mystical. Your audience could hear that, but I can't express the sensation that came in. And I'm telling you, it was mystical. But it wasn't a sense of other beings that were there or even other dimensions. It was just something that had a quality that was unlike and beyond what I experience in everyday life. And also the level of pleasure was too much to handle. My body just couldn't even deal with it.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, that feeling of like, oh, I'm about to wake up and totally leave this reality experience, but I'm not done here. And so I got to shut this down.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like exhilarating and frightening at the same time, but it's very powerful, super powerful. But I want to shift over to talking more about NDEs, actually, because I think one of the most significant elements of NDEs that's not as commonly discussed about them, you know, is the memory question. One of the researchers in the book you quote says that at a time when the brain isn't functioning, the mind is functioning better than ever. And that includes forming memory. So, you know, could we talk more about NDEs and the brain being off and what that tells us about how memory actually works or where memory is accessed from in your research or opinion?
So that quote is from Dr. Bruce Grayson from the University of Virginia. So to add some credibility to this, he's one of the leading researchers in the world on near-death experiences. He said, at a time when the brain isn't functioning, the mind is functioning better than ever. That is a total reversal of the materialistic paradigm, which would say that if the mind is functioning better than ever, then the brain is probably functioning more than ever, because they like to equate brain and consciousness. And the NDEs put into question the nature of consciousness and memory. Is it all from the brain, or is the brain receiving consciousness and even memories? Or is it like a transducer, a filtering mechanism, and the brain and the body access memories from an external place? That might be the case, that perhaps what we call memory parts of the brain indicate that a certain thing has been activated. But the source of the activation could be something external. In other words, it's like we pick up the memory from out there and then we process it internally and then we are able to discuss it, which is that's in stark contrast to the materialistic view, which is that memories are stored in the brain. Perhaps they're stored elsewhere. And that's what these NDEs show. The person's brain is off or it's barely functioning. And like I said, with these veridical out-of-body experiences, these are experiences that are verified memories, not hallucinations. And they're able to come back and relay what happened. So they have a memory of something when their brain was off and they were sometimes clinically dead. I mean, that there are not physiological explanations for that. And when I interviewed for my podcast, Dr. Jan Holden from the University of North Texas, she was talking about these veridical accounts. She says, this wipes out the physiological explanations. That's a very important point because everyone, I know what the skeptical mind wants to do, myself included. Well, it could have been like some kind of an endorphin release or DMT or an oxygen deprivation or CO2. The problem is that those explanations have never been able to account for the totality of these NDE experiences. They might be somewhat related or sound somewhat similar to part of what they describe, but they never get the totality. Dr. Grayson makes that point in his book called After, where he studies NDEs in that book. They cannot explain a verified memory when the brain is barely functional or off.
Yeah, there's, despite, you know, neuroscientists kind of acting like it or just the popular public conception, there is no file cabinet of cells that contains the record of what you did on Tuesday, July 11th, 1972. That just doesn't exist. And as someone that does biofield tuning, I'm way more of the opinion that our memory has something to do with our energy field itself. And that memory is maybe not that that's the only place that memory exists, but particularly memories that are powerfully related to our conditioning in life or what you would consider trauma or limiting beliefs. Like just a couple of days ago, I was doing a tuning for a guy and I hit this and I'm in a different place, right? We're doing it remotely and everything. I'm waving tuning forks around in my living room, talking on the phone to someone in a whole nother state. And I hit this spot and I don't remember the exact age, but I became distinctly aware that at like 7 or 9 or something like that, that he had his bike was taken away by his mom and he really liked that bike. And it had to do with him being in trouble for something. And that experience was like very negative to him and related to a whole web of other negative expectations about life and about not being able to have things that he wanted in the time frame that he wanted them, et cetera. And what's fascinating about that is because that was such a distinct and clear packet of stuck energy that carried that type of a story and the related stories that I don't have time to go into, that he had actually had a more recent experience that I picked up on from within a year of us meeting in this tuning, where there was a question of him and his partner reducing down to one vehicle. And it was, you know, he was fine with it. But then when it came down to it, he basically got unconsciously triggered about the possibility of not having a vehicle when he wanted it, when he needed it. And it was tying back to this experience of having his bike taken away. And what it caused was a big like overreaction and projection towards his female partner, who was taking on the role of the closest feminine energy in his life, the way that his mom would have had that role when he's a child. And so when we find, so like there's something about memory that not only is in our energy field, but also pertains to the potential for cyclically repeating certain types of experiences that are related to our strongest conditioning out of memory that's limiting. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. That there are aspects of the memory that exist with beyond our conscious knowledge in some cases. So it's like we know it, but we can't pinpoint it in a sense. And this leads me to another thing I was thinking of as you spoke of research at the University of Virginia for decades now on children who have memories of a life that is not their own. And sometimes the researchers are able to find historical or medical records that validate what these kids say. They're between the ages of 2 and 6 years old. Often they have phobias and philias, things that they're drawn to that don't really make sense in the context of their life. So they might crave tobacco or something. They might want these. They might want something. They might fear something that's just totally bizarre for the cultural context. And yet they do. So they're having a memory and we can't really trace what from a conventional perspective, where is that even coming from?
And then there's this study that you referenced by Daryl J. Bim about reverse causality in memory. Can you talk about that? Because that one was really interesting.
Is this a quote from the New York Times of I'm trying to remember this one. So people did better on a test if they studied afterwards, a memory test, something like that.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting because after I wrote the book, I interviewed Dr. Bim for my podcast and I asked him about that. And he said that that was one of the, because there were multiple studies on precognition. And I think he told me that was one where the replications weren't as strong, but they were trying
to. Just to make it clear, the effect was that they took a test and then they studied the material after they'd taken the test. Some did, some didn't. And the ones who studied after the test had done better on the actual test, as if the future study made them more knowledgeable or something like that.
I believe that's true. I haven't looked at this in a while. And I think what I was quoting was a New York Times article that was summarizing the findings too. So this made headlines, Daryl Bem's studies on precognition. So the more traditional studies are the ones where the physical body has a response before an image is shown to them on her screen in a manner that corresponds with the image that would eventually be shown to them. And they have no knowledge of what that image is. And so there are studies like this where basically the future is impacting the past, or another way to think about it is our consciousness somehow reaches forward in time before the event happens, because consciousness is beyond space and time. And that's what these precognition studies seem to suggest, even though they're done in different ways.
So has your opinion of the potential for reverse causality, like a future outcome influencing the present moment, shifted since writing an end to upside down thinking? Or do you have a clear understanding, because this is such a wild topic, but what are your current thoughts on that?
I'm very much open to it. I don't think time is well understood. And even when we try to define time, we define it as an interval between two events. And what's an interval? That's a unit of time. So the definition of time is circular. And when we try to think about the past, it's a thought in our consciousness in the present moment. So everything in the past is an inference, even though it's a compelling inference. It's not something we could ever verify, even a picture. We look at the picture in the present moment. We just can't verify all the chain of events that got us to that picture. So how can we really know anything? I mean, the future is also a thought in the present moment. All we know is some kind of an ever-present now, which there's an analogy from Dr. David Hawkins, a spiritual teacher who I really enjoyed. And he said this in a YouTube video that I can't find anymore, but from maybe a decade or so ago. He talked about shining light through a prism and you end up with a hologram. And he would say that hologram's the reality that we're in. And you could look at that hologram from different angles, like different points on this apparently three-dimensional thing. And each of those might represent a different point in time, even though it's part of this one nowness. And when you put those points together, you interpret a sequence of events that's linear and goes from past to present to future. But in reality, it's all part of an ever-present now. They're just different vantage points on it. What that analogy doesn't talk about is what you're alluding to, the fact that maybe that prism itself or the light source is malleable as you go along. So as you make a change at one point, do you affect the future and the past? I'm very much open to that. And from a personal development standpoint, and from a healing standpoint, and probably from a biofield standpoint too, I wonder if the way we think about the past events and future events impacts both. So it's like maybe our future self had a change in thinking that is affecting our current self, which is a bizarre way to think about it. And therefore, thinking about our past self could be valuable, because maybe that's going to have an impact on the past self's consciousness, which is co-occurring in a simultaneous way, which then affects the future. I think these are all, first of all, they seem like things that don't hurt to try, and they seem conceptually possible.
And it doesn't even require there to be a literal past or a literal future. I mean, my understanding of the past and memory is that it is just a story, right? Yeah. And every time that we're remembering something, we're really remembering and potentially altering our story of what that memory is. And in tuning, I found that reframing your perspective on the past can immediately change how it affects you in the present moment. One of my favorite examples of that is a woman who I worked with who had, she was born to a mother who had I don't know, 4 or 5 miscarriages before she successfully had her daughter. And this woman was herself like an acupuncture specialist. So she was really well trained in Chinese medicine concepts. And one of those concepts is that every time the mother has a miscarriage, she loses Jing energy, which is a certain type of vital force. And so the child of a multiple miscarriage mother, according to TCM, would be diminished in their life potential and be more prone to being sickly and things of that nature. And in this tuning, when I uncovered that that was a story she was running with, I was like, but what if the meaning, because you get to decide what things mean for yourself on, in many cases, especially about yourself, what if the meaning of that was that you were actually such a strong life force that that's why you came through, despite the fact that your mom was prone to miscarriages, rather than being weakened by that chain of events? That chain of events could mean to you that actually you were strong. And the relief that I felt in my body and that she immediately had, and like just the complete inversion of a depressed state to a happy and exuberant and vital state that she experienced in that tuning. And there's other stuff we worked on too, but it was like, it was extreme. And that's the type of thing that you should really be mindful of in the story of yourself, especially in your past and your memories. It's like, yeah, but have you ever like consciously decided what it means to you? Or are you running with, again, what somebody else told you it means, the expert or the authority, as in the TCM explanation?
You're reminding me also of Byron Katie's work, the 4 questions you ask about beliefs. And the first one always is that belief true? And the second one is, can I absolutely know that it's true? And to everyone, there's always, we can't know with any certainty. I think the only thing with certainty any of us can know is that in the present moment, we have the feeling that we're conscious right now. That's it. Everything else is some kind of an inference. So especially when it comes to these other beliefs, it's like, well, I think that thing, that belief is true, but I'm actually not sure. Am I absolutely sure? It starts to poke a hole in those beliefs, and many of the beliefs we have are toxic.
So true. They're all worth reexamining. And the problem with a lot of our beliefs that makes it tricky is that we confuse belief for knowing, and the beliefs become invisible by their proximity. And that's why it helps to have a technician sometimes to like, you know, reexamine those things with you. But I want to go back over to NDEs, because one of the areas of NDE research that I had not encountered before, despite being really well-versed in the subject generally, was the experience of blind NDEers. Can you talk a little bit about that before I set up the, you know, what it really makes me wonder about?
Yeah, there's a book called Mindsight by Dr. Kenneth Ring, and I think he had a co-author too, where they go through a number of cases. So if someone has an NDE, they've been blind since birth, for example, and they're able to see things during the NDE, and they come back into the body and they go back to being blind. I think there were cases of deafness and color blindness too that I reference. I think that's right. But there are a bunch in that book. And it actually aligns with normal NDEs, because people who have normal perception and then have an NDE, they will say it's realer than real. And they have 360-degree vision sometimes. So they have things that are paranormal, even from a normal perspective. And then these people where they had some kind of abnormality in their sight or vision, they have the enhanced perception in the NDE too.
And so, they had no memory, some of these people, of ever having seen anything at all. They didn't have a concept for what sight was. And then they had it in the NDE.
Right. So it points to this notion that perhaps the brain gets in the way of a broader reality that always exists around us, but we're just blinded or obstructed by the biology that our consciousness is inhabiting. And when you get the brain out of the way, all of a sudden this world opens up that was previously imperceptible. That's the implication to me. And that goes with psychedelic experiences, certain meditation experiences, anything that's spiritually transformative. There's a similar quality, even though there's a difference, and maybe people go to different places. That's part of it. It's not identical. But the qualities that are similar is this notion that it's an ultra real experience, that the filter has been unlocked. And I think NDEs are an example of that.
Yeah, there were times when I was a more regular meditator where I'd get in the zone and I'd realize I've got my eyes closed, but I can see the entire room around me 360 degrees. And it's a different kind of sight, but it's like it's a strange awareness, and it's a really paradigm changing for the how you see reality. And I think when it comes to the materialist paradigm of how our sensory experiences work, what it makes me believe or infer is that rather than our five senses coming from different parts of the body and then being routed to the CPU that is the brain. And somehow the brain synchronizes all of those signals, even though they're coming from different distances at different speeds or rates, and processing that all into one coherent picture of reality. Maybe there's actually just a oneness of sensory experience that contains all information. And then the brain filters all that and distributes all that to the various sensory apparatus of the body. So rather than it coming from the fingertip to the eyeball and the ear and going into the brain, it's more like the brain is almost sending the signal out to those places in a way, or like that might not even be the right way to conceive of it. But I just can't accept that the brain somehow is doing all that processing to synchronize it all, when we can have, like I've been out of body myself, where we can have full sensory awareness without a brain to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big problem for traditional neuroscience that wants to equate everything with the brain. This implies basically having to rethink all of the entire field, because it just doesn't make sense from a physiological perspective. And as you were talking, you also reminded me of my friend, Dr. Edith Ubuntu Chan, who is about to start a course for children to read blindfolded. She's done this with her children and there are people who train in this. So it's the same thing. They're actually unable to see from a physical perspective, but in their mind, they're somehow able to access the information.
I've heard of those studies, and I was going to ask of those experiments to teach kids blind sight. That is really interesting. I'm definitely going to do that someday with future children. I think that it's totally, gosh, wouldn't that just be a different world that you grow up in if that was something that you learned or at least had an awareness of? But I want to, go ahead.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking of myself. I had no conception of this growing up and as I was an adult. And how would it change your perspective if as a child you knew that your mind was much more than you're told? That probably affects every area of life.
Another one that's the more far out of the spectrum is spoon bending.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that or just other like psychokinetic abilities? What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that that's very real or?
Yeah, I know enough people that have done it. And these are not people like, a lot of people. So I think there's reality to it. I quote Dr. William Tiller in the book, I believe, who was a Stanford professor in material sciences, and he looked at the composition of the metal where there was a bending and found anomalies in the way that it was bent from an alleged spoon bending. So that's interesting. And this is just like with any psychic ability. I don't think it's 100% accurate, and we don't always know why it doesn't work. So sometimes it might not work, but there are enough cases where it has worked, and I think it's probably real. Generally speaking, there are two types of psychokinesis. There's the micro psychokinesis and macro. And the micro is Six Sigma results, where the mind is impacting, for example, the behavior of a random number generator machine, a machine that generates zeros and ones in a random fashion. And they say, hey, Chance, I want you to try to make it to produce more ones and zeros. You're not going to touch it. You're going to use your mind. And they've done this enough times where people are able to do this beyond what Chance would predict. And actually, an observation they found is that when there's a curve to how the performance, initially people do really well, then they start overthinking and they don't do as well. And then they go back to being relaxed and they perform better. So there's something to be said about that. So that's the micro psychokinesis category, where there's a lot of statistical evidence that you could present to a skeptic. There's more anecdotal evidence for the macro stuff. And this even gets into Dr. Dean Radin's book, Supernormal, where he studies like the cities, SIDDHIS, which are the supernatural powers that enlightened masters get. And it's things like levitation or materializing things or incorruption, which I believe is when the body doesn't decompose after it dies, like totally bizarre things. And some of this is psychokinetic, where it's on a mass scale being able to manifest or change the physical world. So there is like I said before, with the basketball analogy, there's a range of abilities. And perhaps as we elevate in our own consciousness, we can do more and more. And maybe the more extreme examples, it's harder for most people to do because they haven't been trained in it, or there could be blockages in their mind. I'm just speculating.
I want to shift gears a little bit to the persuasion side of this, or, you know, the teaching others side of this. And so it's kind of a twofold question, but maybe I shouldn't ask both at once, but I'm going to go for it. First of all, I want to know what you think keeps people from accepting this stuff, even when you got the documents in hand. And then I want to know about your experience with or knowledge of the what you call the Wikipedia guerrilla skeptics. And the latter, or really in both cases, this applies to all the books you've written, not just the consciousness stuff or the medicine stuff.
It's a really important dynamic. What keeps people from believing? I'll start with the first one. Let's say I present a skeptic with the declassified document. Remote viewing is a real phenomenon. They can see the quote in front of them. They'll say, well, they didn't run controlled studies. It's not scientific. You know, there's always an excuse. That paper is an American Psychologist. That's a meta-analysis of many studies. And there's a problem with looking at meta-analysis for some reason. It's never possible that it could be true because it violates the worldview that some people hold, which is that, well, if this is true, then it means that I might have to shift my worldview and there's a reality to the quote unquote spiritual. That's the implication of this. And that can't be true because I know X, Y, and Z and I have a PhD or I'm this level of education. I'm not going to accept it. So that's the kind of behavior that often occurs. And then what you're alluding to with the guerrilla skeptics and taking over Wikipedia pages and making it difficult to edit them. That's like one point of something broader around the notion of censorship, of trying to obstruct this information and not let it get out. And now that I've explored
other teams that do this on Wikipedia, right?
Apparently, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake experienced this firsthand. So I quoted that in the book, what he went through, because his page historically, I haven't looked at it recently, it says his work is pseudoscientific or something very early in his Wikipedia bio. And it says semi-protected with a little key or something like that, meaning that it's difficult to edit. And so like somehow teams take over pages. And what does that mean? If you're just an everyday person, let's say you look at my book, you see that Rupert Sheldrake was one of the people who endorsed it. I quote his work in my book. Let me just Google Rupert Sheldrake. Oh, Wikipedia page. It says he's a pseudoscientist. Okay. Like, what is that? That, if you don't have time, that's a very damning thing.
That happens to Owen Benjamin too. His Wikipedia page is constantly changed to say he's a neo-Nazi and will never say a single good thing about him. Like that he encourages people to have families or teaches homesteading and things like that. It's only like racist, bigot, homophobe, evil. And this, you change it, someone comes back and changes it within minutes. It's really weird. It's like, that's why my friend Gabriel, a slick dissident on YouTube, he calls Wikipedia We Keep Idea instead of Wikipedia, because it's more just like this gatekeeper system. And it's not that there's no value to using it, but when it comes to like the fringe stuff, you got to take it all with a grain of salt and look further into the referenced sources and try to find outside of Wikipedia sources too.
Yeah, I actually quote one of the founders of Wikipedia. I believe his name's Larry Sanger, and he's been outspoken the last few years. These are my political books, but he calls it propaganda for the reasons that you're describing. And it's a symptom of something broader. We see it in the media too, where someone is going to get branded by the media. They're going to say X, Y, and Z about the person, and that's your initial way of thinking about them. And all of a sudden, that person's then on the defense to then show that they're not that thing and to prove that they're beneficial parts. So it's part of a broader, we'll call it social engineering. And in my reset book, I quote Mario Beauregard, who was on a podcast called Skeptico. He's a neuroscientist who studies spiritual topics, and he works in Canada. He says in that interview on Skeptico that he, at a very prominent neurological institute in Canada, he was told by the head of the organization that as long as this person was alive, he would never be allowed to study the brain or those types of issues from a spiritual perspective. I'm paraphrasing. And he said, it's clearly a social engineering thing, that there's, forces at work that suppress information. It's very clear with the consciousness work, but I think it's the tip of the iceberg. It happens in many areas too.
And I guess that leads to a bigger question of one's cosmological framework that they could fit these phenomena into, that begs the question of, well, why would there be these forces repressing information that only ever had the potential to bring more beauty and harmony to society and to the individual? You know, aren't, when it comes to like what they're spraying in the skies and stuff like that, aren't the people who are doing this repression and doing this poisoning living in the same world? That's the big question. And so I wonder, like, you know, your bigger cosmological framework, moving beyond the physicalism or materialism you know, what kind of ism suits you, if any?
I write in my book, An End to Upside Down Contact, it's all about contact with non-human intelligence, I refer to a spiritual war, because I speak about beings that people encounter that some are benevolent. Like in the NDE, a lot of the beings are benevolent. It's a being of light or deceased relatives. So there are hellish ones too. But in other encounters, you have different types of species that people talk about. My conclusion is that there are forces of dark and light, and they're not always physical ones, but they impact humans and perhaps through our consciousness, where we're acting, but we're sort of acting on behalf of an energy that we don't fully appreciate. And perhaps it's because of our own suppressed issues or subconscious beliefs that we're tuning into dark or light. I mean, those are other philosophical questions. But I do think everything we're speaking about here, the social engineering and then even the physical harm that we endure in such a toxic environment, could be the result of a spiritual war that's been playing out for a very long time.
So can you elaborate more on that spiritual war concept? Because actually this is something that started to come out even in the medicine book, which we're going to talk about. We're going to dedicate the second hour to more fully, but that, why would a benevolent universe or benevolent creator even, you know, allow this type of spiritual war to be waged, or like, what's the purpose of it? If there is a grand purpose, that's the big question.
That's the big question. Why is there suffering in the universe? How could that happen if we live in something that is ultimately benevolent? And the answer might be that we think about suffering from a human perspective and we don't understand the full picture. But even from a human perspective, I think about like my tennis days. The more I worked out and trained, as painful as that was, it was physically painful, I would get better at tennis. So suffering led to a good outcome. We see this with dark nights of the soul, where you have a dark night, life's horrible. It seems you come out of it and you learn so much, and then you're a much better person. It's like a metamorphosis. So the spiritual war could be the meta manifestation of that dark and light that's intended to stimulate evolution. That's the benevolent take on it. I know some people think that we're trapped too, but even in the case of a trap, there's always the notion that you escape to go home to this benevolent place, which implies that the trap exists within the benevolent place, which means the trap must have been allowed, which means there's a reason that it was allowed. So to me, that even points to net benevolence in a way. And therefore, we could look at what's happening in the world, because it's becoming increasingly turbulent, as opportunities for us to evolve and transcend past where we are. And that's how I see the spiritual war, and even any sort of test or horrific thing that's out there is a opportunity for us to evolve. Now, the flip side of that perspective is it could be easy to say, well, yeah, there's horrible stuff in the world. That person's suffering over there being tortured. It's okay, because it's just evolutionary. There is still a need to try to alleviate suffering. And David Hawkins put this really well. And this is, again, in a YouTube clip that I can't find anymore. But he was speaking to a Buddhist monk and said, you know, Ramana Maharshi, who's a famous Indian sage, he used to say that the world that we see doesn't exist. And Hawkins said, well, from that perspective, the super enlightened level, that's a true statement. But most people in the world are not operating from that perspective, and therefore they're experiencing real suffering. And Hawkins said it would therefore be a spiritual error to ignore the suffering of people, even though at some level the suffering is not real. And it was for that reason, actually, that he came back into the world after leaving psychiatry to meditate for years, because he wanted to help people and felt like there was a karmic or spiritual duty to do so. So I see it as this balance of, we shouldn't just accept the suffering and do nothing. We should try to alleviate it to the best of our ability. And at the same time, we can understand that suffering could be part of a net beneficial process that's evolutionary.
I really like that answer. My personal experience jives with it, that the bad is illusory in a way, because it always leads to good in a long enough outcome eventually. Yeah. So that really helps. But I also agree that only occurs when we do our best to alleviate the bad or to resolve our incorrect thinking or behavior that is causing the suffering in ourselves and in others. And, you know, there is really not a separation between the suffering in ourselves and others. You quote this dude, Rupert Spira. It's funny that his name actually means spirit in Latin in the book. And he says, each of us is as such, the same apparently diversified and separated through the kaleidoscope of thought and perception. We are literally each other. Each of us is the outer face, or the objectification of the only mind there is, eternal, infinite consciousness. We are all mirrors of the same consciousness. That sentiment is the whole reason I even started this show years ago, and it's been a fun journey to find more and more reasons to believe that or to know that. But as we're wrapping up the first hour, I want to remind people to check out your book and Into Upside Down Thinking if they like this conversation, because all of the direct examples of the NDEs, of the psychic experimentation, of people bending spoons and the accounts of that, it's just full of them. It's like 11 hours of a nonstop data fest. And I really enjoyed it. But if you wanted to let people know, you know, your closing thoughts on that subject matter before we transition to hour two, or ways that things that you want to plug or let them know about, that'd be great.
I want to respond to the Rupert Spira quote that we are literally each other, because this is one of the areas where my thinking has transformed a bit since I wrote the book. So I totally agree with his sentiment at one level. The problem is, and I saw this especially starting in 2020 with everything that was happening in the world, that a lot of the people that believe that were then falling for the narratives from the media and elsewhere, and the medical narratives that we now know were not accurate. And they were endorsing it from a place of compassion, that we're all interconnected and therefore these things are correct. So what I've talked about in other books is the notion of compassion with discernment, rather than just one or the other. Because you could have, I see this all the time, people with great discernment, no compassion, very mean, but they're very discerning. And then the other side, very compassionate. We're all one. It's love and light. But the discernment's not there, especially when it comes to deception. On that love and light side, what I find is that it's like there's this implicit belief that evil is easy to spot. It's the mean person on TV who doesn't speak nicely. It's the mass murderer, the serial killer. And it's not the person who speaks nicely and speaks about equality, but underneath the surface has a much more negative intent, the wolf in sheep's clothing, which is really critical to understanding this whole world in every area, which is why I've continued writing. So part of the reason I've continued writing is I was so baffled and frustrated that I was like, if we just understood the oneness, I thought we would be good. And now we're totally not good, even though some people do understand the oneness. They're taking us off the cliff. What's going on here? So it's this balance of the non-duality, the oneness, and the duality, that I'm an individual and not an individual together. What happens is people go to the extreme of one or the other. I'm only an individual. The collective doesn't matter. I'm only the collective. The individual doesn't matter. And I talk about this in my political book on liberty. I talk about an individualistic collectivism, this hybridization of both, because you need both in order for us as society, I think, to evolve.
That is a slam dunk, Mark. That is, it's exactly how I feel about it. We have to surf that paradox of unity consciousness and being an individual. The word individual actually means that very thing of like an undivided whole oneness. And, you know, you can't fall so many of the traps of that we're going to talk about in part two, like the mythical concept of the public health, are exploited massively by the would-be compassion of those who are kind of too far into that collectivist paradigm. And it's amazing. It's amazing that you picked up on that and finished with that thought, because I think that is incredibly important to highlight whenever we're talking about these things of like the non-separation of consciousness or the universality of our life force energy. It doesn't mean that, you know, it's like the big misconception there is that it means that we should sacrifice our little self for the whole, for the big self. But what somehow they're missing the point that if we all sacrifice ourselves for the collective, then everybody is sacrificed. So that mm-hmm. doesn't work.
Right. And it translates into tyrannical behavior politically of, oh, this is for the greater good. Therefore, if we have to put these people in camps or murder these people, that's okay because it's for the greater good. And it sounds horrific, but that's what history is all about. It's always an extreme collectivism that is used to justify horrific behavior. So my concluding thought is that the oneness that this consciousness model points to, where all this science that we talk to points toward a oneness that is insufficient, in my view, for an evolved way of thinking and for an evolved society.
really cool to see how your thinking has expanded since that first book. And I'm definitely going to want to check out your other ones in between the first and the last. But do you have anything planned that you're working on next, or ways that people might be able to connect with you more thoroughly, or stuff that you want to let people know about as we wrap up the free hour?
Yeah, I don't have any new projects, but if your audience members are interested in checking out my work, my website is a good place to start. It's just my name, markgober.com, markgober.com. I have 6 books. They're all an end upside down something. And they're in hard copy, Kindle, and Audible format. I read the Audible for all of them. And as you said before, my podcast, Where Is My Mind, which features my interviews with many of the people I wrote about in an end upside down thinking, including Dr. Grayson from UVA, including Brian Josephson, who's a Nobel Prize winning physicist, of some very high caliber people. That's in the 8 episode series, Where Is My Mind, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. I've heard from a lot of people it's a good way to just to binge. These are half hour to 45 minute episodes, just 8 of them. So you can get up to speed on this stuff pretty quickly. Although I would say the book, if you want to get the full amount of data, I would go there.
Yeah, man, it's a great book. And really enjoyed this first hour. I feel like it's a whirlwind tour that would be a paradigm buster for anybody new to these subjects. And thanks for your time. Looking forward to part 2.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the great Mark Gober. Guys, if you're not upside right after that conversation, or you know, you can't pass that to somebody who's a little upside down and see them get upside right, I don't know. I don't know what's going to do it. But then again, that's me coming from the perspective of considering what was in the plus extension. I really liked the first part, though. It's obvious that Mark is a high performer. I think a lot of us in the questioning everything realm might even hear the credentials that Mark had starting out, you know, Princeton and Wall Street finance and et cetera, et cetera, and think, oh, I gotta look at this guy sideways. But there's something that is not as often considered, is that to even be in those positions that Mark has held, you have to be a certain type of driven. You have to be a certain type of potent as a force in the world. And that's why those institutions are so powerfully influential on our world, is that, like, the same with Hollywood. We like to demonize all of the actors and the producers in the Hollywood world. But for friends of mine like Dylan Sarcosio, who actually tried to make it in Hollywood, it takes serious work, serious dedication, serious, like, follow through with your craft. And I think most people out there that are just on the passive consumer tip are not aware of what it really means to be on the level of a super high performer. So I love that. And I love that in the process of his journey, Mark has made it into the sweet spot of having his profession be completely identical to a spiritual path. That is awesome. After the recording of the conversation, we started talking about some other things that I think are upside down. You know, I'm telling them about reasons why you shouldn't trust the spinning ball flying through an infinite void. And he's just so cool and open to those things. And we got into all kinds of cool topics after the podcast that I kind of wish were recorded. But that just goes to show me that we have an excellent rapport. We're going to have fun in the future. Looking forward to what he's going to do next. And I think before he even writes another book, I'd love to have him on to talk about something else that he's done. Particularly the end of Upside Down. I don't know what it's called, but it has to do with the UFO contact, AET question. That will be an interesting one, especially to put through the lens of, like, there is no outer space or it's not as described. Anyway, he was really open to all that. I loved it. I really enjoyed part 2, though, which you're going to have to get onto my membership subscription, either through Patreon, Rockfin, or the YouTube membership option if you want to hear part 2. But ultimately, that was a complete shift of gears where we talked about the end of upside down medicine, which is Mark's investigation into the whole field of virology and allopathy. And dang, that was what I always wished I could hear or interview somebody about back when cooties was popping off. I really feel like I'm complete now as a podcast host, that I finally got this information well articulated into a show. Maybe a little late to the party. I know people like Alex Zek and Mike Winner and the whole team at the end of COVID have already kind of traveled this ground. But for me, this was something that I really needed a few more pieces in the puzzle to fully comprehend and break out of the germs paradigm. And if that's something that you're on the fence about, or you just would like to have some better ammunition for how you can competently dispute and persuade in conversation with those who are open-minded to the topic after seeing all of the fraud of the last couple of years, then this second hour is going to be really good for you. Or just get his book. Like, you know, I'm not trying to gatekeep here. You could just, instead of subscribing to me, just get Mark's book and get way wider range of the data. But in the second part, you get my hot take on some of these things, which I think has some value. Anyway, we talked about in the Plus Extension why Mark wrote the book and into Upside Down Medicine, the correlation of the belief in viruses and victimhood, victim consciousness. We discussed the early models that influenced virology, the many freedom of information requests that were done that failed to secure even a single record of the existence of a cooties particle or any other type of cooties. We discussed why virology doesn't even qualify as science. And then I tried to inject some compassion for the medical order followers while also being realistic about how that whole system works and what they're conditioned to do. This was one of my favorite things we talked about was, did the cowpokes of the past actually eliminate polio and other diseases? Or are there other explanatory factors as to why certain things that may have seemed contagious or seemed to be affecting a large amount of people would go away or be reduced? And Mark's book goes deep into that with other topics too, like AIDS and chicken pox and some other stuff. Rabies. I always get that one. But what about rabies? We asked the question if the mRNA alteration is a real thing or an illusion too, kind of breaking into the whole question of genetic research as potentially being just as upside down as what we talked about in the medical side. Then we switched over to discussing consciousness's effect in medicine, especially the extreme spontaneous healing that has been documented via consciousness shifts. And in addition, like NDEs that have facilitated that kind of a healing. I brought up the mystical origins of modern medicine. And then as we discussed the biofield concept and bioresonance, particularly cellular bioresonance, you know, I couldn't help but pose the question of what about placenta sorcery and bioresonance? This is a serious question. I'm not kidding around with that. It's huge. Overall, though, this was just super fun. There's a lot more in the books that we didn't get to talk about in this conversation. You know, back to the end of Upside Down Thinking, there's a whole thread about shared death experiences that was kind of new to me, where people are there with a loved one when they cross over and they actually experience the life review with them. That seems potentially very embarrassing to me. But I guess at that point in the bittersweet goodbye moment, all of it would be accepted and allowed and okay. But I kind of hope that doesn't happen when I leave. Seems embarrassing. I guess it'll be, you know, in the whole grand scheme of consciousness being a big unified field of life force energy, there are no secrets anyway. So there's nothing to be embarrassed about. We're all in it. We're all making mistakes. We're all alive. That's part of it. But we also didn't get to talk as much about the concept of life after death in the ways that mediumship evidences that. I find that interesting. I actually myself have a story where I experienced mediumship. I was at this, I've told it before on the podcast, but I think it's worth telling right now because it's so interesting how there's like verifiable things that can be brought through in mediumship. I don't consider myself a medium any further than what I think anybody could potentially be a medium, that we all have the ability to tap into that stuff. But one time I was at this magic festival. I was there to sell art, really, and promote my podcast years ago. But it was a bunch of occultists, essentially. And in the area where I had my tent set up, this group was going to do a seance at midnight. And so I had the option of either joining the seance or going to sleep and letting my guard down next to the opening of some kind of interdimensional spirit portal. I chose to participate instead. And in the process, it's kind of a longer story than what I'm going to give now, but I elected, like, mentally that I wanted to be chosen as the medium, because there was like sort of a selection process of who was going to be the medium. And I told the spirits or whatever in my mind, like, I volunteer. And of course, I got selected amongst a group of about 30 people. So that was pretty cool. And anyway, the long story short of it was the process of doing the mediumship was sort of like a guided meditation where the facilitator of the seance was telling me, you know, go to a place that's familiar and nature, and then like find a body of water and cross it, and you're going to see a house or a mansion, you're going to go into it. And I followed all these steps and I'm mentally visualizing it, eyes closed, and I go into this building. And one of the things I eventually encounter was this old man, and he had like a gold circular wire-framed glasses on, and he's jumping up and down and pointing at his shin. And I can't remember what his name was, but basically it ended up being the recently deceased grandfather of somebody who was there in the circle. And what made her finally jump out and say, that sounds like you're describing my grandfather based on how he looks and what he, and all that, was the pointing at the shin feeling, similar to this. She said he used to do a dance called the shin dig. So there I am, like, kind of pulling that out more symbolically. And then I was asked if he had a message for his granddaughter. And as soon as I got that question, I immediately felt the, this intense emotion of love and pride that was like turning the faucet on, where I was at neutral and then the faucet is turned on to full. And there's this rushing of emotional energy that was so powerful that it was like almost too much. And then it was turned off immediately. And so it was like a really bizarre experience, because usually there's like a ramping up, physiologically speaking, there's like a ramping up and a decline of a strong emotional state, but it was like on, off, intense, and then gone. And it was all just to express the message to his granddaughter of how proud he was, how much he loved her and all that. But it was a really cool experience. There was other like mystical things that happened during that seance. And it, I already kind of was in a more woo-woo paradigm of my worldview, but still, that was a huge one because it gave me a lot of verifiable connection. And then, and you know, occasionally in tuning sessions, I will encounter a deceased loved one that has a message. That's happened. I don't look for that on purpose, but it does happen. And so with all that, it's been a fun episode. Look forward to talking to Mark again. If you want to support the podcast, there's lots of ways to do it, linked in the show notes. My favorite would be Tippecanoe Herbs, using the Interverse coupon code for a great discount. Or you can also book a biofield tuning session with me. That is an awesome option. Like, the results, as I described in the conversation with Mark, are mind-blowing and phenomenal. So I hope you guys will check that out. And with that, I'm going to let you guys go. It's been a fun time. Thanks for tuning in. If you're new to the podcast, go check out the archives. There's a bazillion things that I know you're going to like that are much esoteric information. Will blow your mind. We're the deep end over here, the inner verse. So catch you guys on the next one. Much love. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.